every time I went out, I would drink to the point that I would black out. And on one occasion, I went to Mexico with a couple of my uni friends and I drank 11 tequilas, blacked out, and I woke up. I don't know if I should say this, so you can cut out whatever's not.
Well, you just say what you want. Don't say if you don't want to say anything.
But no, because it's an important part of my story. I blacked out and I woke up in a van the following day, like, basically very little clothing, and realised there were 6 guys in the van. Something terrible had happened. And then, you know, I think that's the first time that I started to feel shame about myself. So it wasn't only my parents' shame that I was carrying, then I had my own. And that's when my drinking really started again.
I'm Paul Scolfort, and this is Powerful. In this series, I come clean about my own sobriety and the journey it took for me to get here. In each episode, I will speak to a special guest about their addictions and how they achieve sobriety and how they maintain a happy lifestyle today. Yasmin, our guest today, is a proud mother of 2 children. Yasmin is currently a successful property developer and has survived a harrowing battle with addiction and alcoholism. Gratefully, she has found recovery, and I'm honoured that she's agreed to share her story with us. So in some of these episodes, there will be discussions of alcohol misuse, drugs, sexual abuse, suicide, and some other heavy topics. So please take care when listening. Hi, Yasmin. Welcome to This Is Powerful.
Thank you.
I've been looking forward to this conversation. Thank you very much. How long have you been sober?
It's actually 450 days today.
Oh, well done. That's amazing. I'm going to jump straight into your early life.
It's quite ironic being in this area because I was born in 1970 in Bethnal Green Hospital. And I was born to the sound of the bow bells in quite a impoverished hospital. And I came 6 weeks early. And when I was placed in my mother's arms, apparently she started to scream. Reason being is I was born with 6 fingers on one hand.
All right.
And that kind of epitomizes, I think, how I felt throughout my life, kind of flawed, unwanted and restless because I came so early.
I've never heard you say about that. I'm assuming that, did you have it taken off early?
Yeah, they put a piece of string around it and it actually fell off in my aunt's afro.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Did things get better with your mum after that?
My father was he came over from Pakistan initially, and my mum was a little blonde Irish woman, very strong-willed and, quite a force of nature, to be fair. And they lived in Bethnal Green. They started business together. Their neighbours were the Crays, and on one occasion, again, this is a story that has been passed through, but my mum and dad were walking down Commercial Road and I think it was Reggie said to my mum, "You packy lover." And my mum hid him with her handbag. And wow. And the only reason why there were no repercussions is my mum had befriended their mum. And so she knew, they were basically told, leave Joan alone. She's a friend of mine. And actually, the next day, again, this is the story that's been
I love these stories
on.
Passed down in East End, by the way.
My mum left my sister in a pram outside a newsagent after this incident, I think the following day. And there was an envelope in the pram with £1,000. And it said, to the only woman other than our mum that's ever taken us on, or something to that effect.
Wow.
Yeah. So
a little mutual respect.
Yeah. So, my mum... Yeah, she, like I said, she was a force to be reckoned with, and she was very business-minded, and her and my dad made a great team to begin. They had a 3-story building on Commercial Road. They lived on the top floor. The middle floor was their offices for the business they started, and the bottom floor was the factory. And apparently every time one of my dad's Pakistani relatives came over to visit, they were basically kidnapped and put in the cellar and made to work for the family company.
By your family?
Yes.
Interesting. That's unusual for that time then, for your parents from different races to meet.
Yeah.
How did that come about?
Well, my father, he was always a womanizer. My mum's a beautiful. She had striking blonde hair, blue eyes. And apparently they met at a party. And what my dad always says is that the first thought when he met her was she would make a good business partner, because that's his mind was only about business, making money. You know, coming from Pakistan, you know, that was the dream, to come to England and become successful.
Yeah.
And he did manage to do that.
And did you stay in the East End? Because if the business is going to grow that quickly, I'm sure you'd have moved out somewhere.
We moved to Thaden Boys. And yes, at that time, it was predominantly a very white village. There was no mixed race children. There were no people of Asian descent or colour. So we were kind of the novelty. But once again, my mum then, she was still a very strong character, you know, and she quickly integrated into the village, made lots of friends, which made the transition easier. But still, at school, we were called the brown kids by the dinner ladies, put to the back of the line.
Right.
And there was a lot of prejudice.
It sounds something that should be like 100 years ago.
Yeah,
not
no,
a short
exactly.
time ago, right?
Yeah.
And so how was your life at school then? Did that kind of affect you in any way, that you was different from others?
Yeah, I mean, by then, you know, things at home, again, you know, the purpose of this podcast is really, you know, for me to kind of explain part of my childhood in the respect that why my life turned out the way it did. And, you know, both of my parents were alcoholics. My father was a functioning one. And so there was a lot of secrets at home. And when you go to school, where you also don't feel like you fit in, kind of you're on the outskirts, it was a very difficult childhood for me.
Seeing alcohol in my family and the effects that it had on people, it really put me off to the point where I would always say when I was younger, I'm never going to drink. Why would you drink? I remember tasting, my mum was at the London Hospital for a year and a half. She was very ill with neurofibroma. And so we would drive up and down the A13, when you could drive up and down the A13 with no traffic lights, twice a day to see her every day. And I remember one day we went to see her. She weighed about, she's quite a tall lady, my mum. She weighed about 5 stone and they wasn't sure if she was going to make it. And my granddad took me down the pub, which I spent a lot of time, and said, what do I want to drink? And I wanted to be like him because he was my hero. He was an amazing guy. And he had half a Guinness.
Right.
And I said, can I have half a Guinness? And I tasted it. And I'll never forget that taste. It was like drinking metal at that time. I just thought, why? The taste isn't even nice. So why would you want to do that? How did that affect you in the sense, like, when was your first drink?
And well, again, very like you, I saw the effect it had on my parents, you know, and you know, when my father drank, he was from a military background in Pakistan. He was a boxer. Yeah. And for some reason, when he drank, he turned into that kind of that very aggressive, untouchable, unapproachable man. But my mum, on the other hand, when she drank, yeah, she became more loving almost. But at the same time, that didn't last very long. You know, her deterioration from, also she was ill a lot. She suffered from Meniere's disease, which is a disease of the ear where you, it's actually what Van Gogh had. So you know in the story that Van Gogh tried to cut his ear off?
Yeah.
He suffered, they think, with Meniere's disease. So basically it's a constant ringing, but much worse than just a small, I mean, like an aeroplane, my mum used to describe
so
it.
So worse taking than off. Tinnitus.
Yeah, exactly. And so in the end, they actually took the eardrum out. But she was in hospital a lot. And whenever she would go into hospital, my dad would bring another woman into the house. And yeah, usually housekeepers, or there was a teacher from school. And so that's where the secrets were. When my mum was in hospital, another woman would share my father's bed. And when she came home, we weren't allowed to tell her. And my mum, because of that, she was aware of what was going on, and she also, you know, struggled a lot with her health. And so her drinking progressed very quickly. And she was no longer that vibrant, beautiful woman. There was no longer laughter when she drank. It was a lot of depression. And yeah, that's all I remember. I remember her in bed a lot and just not happy.
It's really strange how it affects people in different ways. Some people just drink and go out and party and it's crazy.
Yeah.
But I really believe there's a lot of people who quietly medicate themselves.
That's...
You know, because alcohol takes away pain, emotional pain, mental pain, physical pain.
Yeah. And that's the miracle of recovery, because for so many years I had therapy and it vindicated me as a victim of childhood trauma. It didn't allow me to understand my mum's alcoholism. She suffered from a disease. She had no choice, you know, and growing up I always felt so abandoned and rejected and unwanted. But it wasn't her power of choice was taken away when her alcoholism developed. And, you know, through recovery, I've learned to forgive myself for doing the same thing to my children, because, you know, that power of choice is taken away. It's so much more than just a choice to pick up a drink. And for my mom, it's a solution to a lot of things.
That's the thing that's hard to explain to people.
Yeah.
Is that... you know, my dad always said it as well, even though he definitely had his drinking bouts to deal with stuff, but I don't believe he's an alcoholic. He definitely has his isms. I think it jumped a generation and I got it nicely. But his saying was, well, if you don't drink, you know, just put it down, you'll be fine. And I think people don't understand once you're afflicted with this illness and your necessity to have alcohol in your system is there. Once you've crossed that line, then it is a coping mechanism. And I think that people, they're not conscious of it. They just do it. And it's just something you have to do, because life gets more painful inside. Exactly. The prison in your mind gets bigger, or smaller rather. And you're on that merry-go-round that you can't get off.
Yeah.
And it's really hard to explain that to people, isn't it?
No, exactly. And, you know, like I said, but even, you know, I had two... parents who, my father's alcoholism is very different to my mother's. You know, my father never drank until 6 p.m. in the evening. He would function very well. But, you know, I remember on a couple of occasions he was on medication. They said, you can't drink. And he couldn't. He would rather not take the medication. So his need for the alcohol, but there was still an element of control within his drinking.
Funny, right? Probably come from the military side and the boxing side.
Probably.
How did you get from Thaden Boyce to California?
So there's a lot of history. So again, with my mum's illness and my father's bigger me, and there was a lot of violence in our house, and my mum and dad's relationship really deteriorated. Basically, my mother, that's the thing too, without going into too much detail, but, you know, alcoholism, again, it's, you know, it takes you to a very dark place. And for my mother, you know, it was her solution, but she knew it wasn't working anymore. And so she often tried to end her life. And often, you know, as children, you just think, I'm not good at, why aren't we enough? Why, how can you even contemplate, you know, leaving us? But
was that young in your childhood? Or?
Yeah, no, like it happened quite a lot. Yeah, from the age, I mean, I've blacked out a lot of my childhood, but I remember two particular incidences, you know, very vividly, where we found her. And obviously she knew she couldn't stay in that environment anymore. And we used to go on holiday a lot to California in the summer. And my father had started to open a business there. And so we'd already kind of placed roots there. And then it was decided that my mum would bring us three children to America and my father would follow once he got rid of all the women that he had in the UK. And I remember my mum, she's very sheepishly came into my sister and I's bedroom one evening and said, look, you know, your dad and I, we're going to have child separation, but he's going to come and join us and we're going to move to America. And she thought that we'd be like, no. I mean, I remember this like in great detail. When she left the room, my sister and I held hands. We were jumping up and down on the bed. I think from relief of leaving this formidable figure that was my father, that I had so much fear of. And also moving to California, you know, where this everything was bigger and better. Little did I know that there was just going to be the repeat of exactly the same thing, because, you know, the insecurities I had growing up. And they say too, in, you know, when I went to see therapists later on, they often said, you know, you were, your trauma, it would be safe to say that your trauma was enough to make you into an alcoholic. But it wasn't my trauma. It was my reaction to my trauma that I think made me look at alcohol as a solution, because you develop certain coping mechanisms, and wherever you are in the world, those come with you.
Especially if you're not allowed to say anything.
Exactly.
We had a rug that was about that high, because everything gets swept under the rug.
Oh, yeah. No.
Just keep it in the house.
Yeah.
I think that was that 70s, 80s period.
No, absolutely.
Anyway, so when you went to California, was that not there? And when did you find your first drink?
When I was, before we went to America, again, I was like you. I hated the thought of drinking. I hated the thought of acting like my parents did. You know, I would see a physical change literally after their first drink. And I used to dread when my mum would start to slur. I used to dread when I would see the aggression. And I said, I'll never drink. And I remember when I was 14, we went on a school trip with school when I was still in the UK, right before we left. And it was to Italy. And we all stayed in these little rooms. And I was there with my best friend. And I can't remember what it was, but it was Valentine's Day. And she got a card under our little bedroom door. And I didn't. And it just set off that emotion again. Nobody likes me. I'm not pretty. I'm not liked by my friends. And that night we went to a bar. And I think my friend had maybe one or two drinks. Some of my other school friends had a couple, but some, I don't know how, but either I was drinking the rest of theirs on top of mine, but I was paralytic. And that was the first time I touched alcohol. So I had an abnormal reaction to alcohol for the first time I ever drank.
Did you know it then? And what I mean by that is, some people say when they take the first drink, there's such a relief from all the stress and all the pain they've had. And some just say, I got completely in oblivion and didn't want to do it again. And some people say, I don't remember a thing.
It's mad, because I just remember being carried back by to the teacher and two of my friends back to the hotel. And I remember, I kind of remember having that drink and thinking, God, I feel really good. Like, I feel like everybody likes me suddenly. But then if it's your first drink and you're gulping everybody, you're going to go into blackout quite quickly, which I did. And I remember the next day when I woke up, my friend looked at me and said, like, what happened? You know, one minute you were fine, the next minute you're like lying on the floor, you know, and that was my first experience. So now looking back, now that I'm in recovery, I realize, you know, my first drink, I had an abnormal reaction. For me, everybody else had a couple of sips. I downed whatever was given to me.
That thought, though, you had about everyone likes me, feeling a bit different, did that stay with you? And because I've heard people say that I immediately felt better looking, taller, funnier, and I couldn't wait to get drunk
again.
This
is the interesting, and I'm glad you asked about America. I think things would have been very different. If I would have stayed in the UK, I would have quickly started going to pubs and drinking. But like you said, it's not accessible in California. So eating disorder developed as a way to kind of change the way I felt, because you couldn't get alcohol. You know, when I went to university at 17, I started. Yeah, I got a fake ID and then I drank. And then again, it accelerated quite quickly. But in those couple of years in between, I didn't really, because it wasn't available. It wasn't the thing. So instead, I developed bulimia, which again, it's another way of changing the way you feel.
Yeah, it's another
way. It's an addiction,
it's a food addictions or eating disorders are painful, aren't they? Because you have to eat.
Yeah. For me, though, I think it's slightly, I think I completely, relate to everything. But my sister had the opposite. She grew up with a very severe anorexia. And I think, you know, my father couldn't handle her eating, like the fact that she didn't eat, because it took the secret from outside, indoors to outside. You know, you can't hide a child who weighs 3 stone. And for him, that's very difficult to cope with. So he would make her eat, you know, he would force food into her mouth. And when she didn't, there'd be repercussions, you know. And I thought, well, if I overeat, then I'll get his attention because I'm overeating as a result. I turned into everything, again, he didn't want me to be because he wanted his children to look perfect. And I became quite overweight. And
so sad when you're younger, though, that you have to, it's the desire to connect, isn't it, with your parents?
Exactly.
And so many people in the rooms of a 12-step program say that, that all they want to have is a connection.
Yeah, absolutely. And also when, if you're given labels, we were given labels as children, so my sister was the beautiful one because she had very angular features. I was the intelligent one. And my brother...
With angular features.
That's what I mean. My brother, he was the long-awaited son. You know, they wanted him from the first child. And so when you're given a label on top of the fact you don't fill in, the only identity you have is that label your parents give you. And for me, it was always I had to perform well at school. My sister had to look perfect. And, you know, but the labels would cross over. So for my father, if we didn't look the way he wanted us to, if there was any indication that there was problems or anything, we were told, you know, to be quiet. But if visually you're showing those things, you know, that's why it would never hit us on our faces, because it would show, you know, so it was always... where it couldn't show.
Sometimes you hear stories and you just think, no wonder people drank and did what they did. Because it's, you know, we all have different versions and stuff. And Gabor Mate talks about 51% of people in addiction have had some form of trauma.
Yeah.
I think there's definitely that component. And I also think there's the genealogical part that's passed down.
Yeah, definitely. So the combination, those two things, I didn't really have a chance.
No, but, no. You know, when did you have your first drug?
So that's actually quite interesting. When I, God, this is actually bringing back. When I was in high school, like I said, I didn't really drink and I suffered with bulimia. And then I don't actually remember, because again, I have a lot of blackouts, but I remember trying crystal meth. And in those days, it was like cocaine. So you could sniff it and it was quite readily available.
And this is in California, right?
Yeah. And I tried it and I got hooked on that really quickly. So I didn't drink, I just did that. But when I went to university, that stopped. So it also helped with my eating. It helped me control my appetite. So
yeah, completely.
Yeah. But I didn't really like the stimulant effect. I like the fact that it made me feel confident and beautiful and capable, but it wasn't the solution. It wasn't the answer. It didn't make me feel or give me that kind of harm which alcohol did.
Yeah. Did you just stop doing the meth, which is really rare? You wouldn't have heard that in England.
No.
It's definitely like a California thing, I imagine. No, I don't think that was in New York back then, was it?
Yeah, no, probably not. No, California. I mean, it was like you'd do and then you'd be up for 3 days. And obviously my mum knew something was wrong. But I've always suffered with ADHD. So you could perhaps say that those, that I could use that as an excuse. But yeah, like I said, I went to university. And I remember once again, you know, it was an Ivy League school and... there was a lot of expectation of me from my father because I wanted to study art, but I was told he wouldn't finance me unless I studied economics, but I rebelled in my own little way
and added... Back to the business.
Yeah, and I added philosophy as a minor because I always had that... I don't know, when I look back now, I always had this kind of need, like the seeking, like there has to be more to life than just this. And for philosophy, I would read Sartre and I would... just Nietzsche and I was always looking for something. I just thought this can't be life, like there has to be more
I'm smiling.
Yeah.
Because my next question was, philosophy means love and wisdom. No. Were you searching for something?
Oh, my goodness. No way. I promise you, I haven't seen those questions. I was always searching for something. Always.
It's so funny because I, you know what? I traveled once on an airplane when I was 15 to box as a boxer for competition. And then I flew to Mallorca for the first time. So I didn't even fly till I was 15. So I didn't have experience of different cultures and stuff. But I was always searching for something. And when I started to model and travel, literally it was like, this is what I'm doing. I'm just going to search just to learn about cultures, food, places, religions, spirituality. Yeah. And that was kind of like a thread that I was really, really trying to search.
Yeah. Yeah, me too. I always, like, people used to say, like, not often to me, because I was always quite miserable and down, and I always looked like I didn't really, I just didn't fit in. I always was kind of on the outskirts of the party, as you could say. Even growing up, you know, at school, I could only have one friend. I couldn't deal with social situations very well.
This was my next question.
No,
we're like, we're in tune. I was going to ask you about your friendships.
No, yeah.
Because I used to have one friend at a time.
Yeah, me too.
Very deep relationships and friendships, yeah. And then they'd go.
Looking back, in university, I remember I isolated myself a lot. You know, when I saw beautiful girls or, people that seemed very popular, I just kind of stood in the outskirts. I didn't feel socially inept. I just felt very socially inept. I couldn't start conversations. I couldn't. And I was always comparing myself to everybody. And yeah, and I remember I joined a sorority like about 6 months in and a year of blackout. So I started drinking properly, had a fake ID. And I remember I had alcohol poisoning various occasions.
Was that flagged at uni at all?
Not really, because I was living in accommodation, but my father knew I didn't like living with others. So he bought me a house there. By then, his businesses had started to do very well. But being business-minded like I am, I rented out the house.
Very smart.
And went got a little studio apartment down in Laguna Beach. And so again, I was on my own. I liked my own company. And then I kind of stopped going to classes, but because I've always been, and again, I could say that now, I could never say that before, I've always been quite intelligent. And so I could manage to keep up for 3 years, but towards the end, it all just became too much and I stopped going to classes. I was drinking not as heavily as my first year, but I was just drinking to cope with the pressure of uni, the pressure of not feeling adequate, the pressure of feeling like I didn't belong there and you know, still a lot going on with my parents back home. And for me, it was a solution just to live, to exist. Yeah. I couldn't just use the tools I was given as a human being. It wasn't enough for me.
Did you have an inkling at that point? Because it is kind of black and white, especially around Laguna Beach. If you're not a surfer and you're smoking and drinking, like people are pretty much sober, aren't they?
Yeah, no, they are. And I again, it was mostly alcohol then when I think back. Crystal meth didn't really come back into the picture.
Thank God.
Yeah, but when I drank, yeah, I have no teeth while I'm sitting.
Well, you probably won't be here now.
No, true. But yeah, my drinking, it was every time I went out, I would drink and I would drink to the point that I would black out. And on one occasion, I went to Mexico with a couple of my uni friends and
Tijuana.
Yes.
I've got a Tijuana story. I'll let you say
yours. Yeah, my one, unfortunately, is pretty tragic. I drank 11 tequilas and blacked out and I woke up. I don't know if I should say this, so you can cut out whatever's not.
Well, you say what you want. Don't say if you don't want to say anything.
But no, because it's an important part of my story. I blacked out and I woke up in a van the following day, with very little clothing, and I realized there were six guys in the van and something terrible had happened. And then, you know, I think that's the first time that I started to feel shame about myself. So it wasn't only my parents' shame that I was carrying, then I had my own. And that's when my drinking really started again. And then it stopped for a little while, and then it would start again. And that was a continuing pattern for many years.
How long did you just put that situation behind you and just
Yeah, I pretend it never happened.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't really tell anyone. My mom was, by that point, her drinking had escalated. You know, whenever I would come back from uni to her house, she lived about half an hour away in La Mirada. And I would pretty much find her on the floor. I'd have to put her to bed. And she was a very angry, resentful person at that stage. And our relationship, even though I'd never really felt that she was the typical mother, you know, we still had lines of communication, but then it started to really deteriorate.
Yeah. Did you seek any help early on? You said you've been around for 10 or 12 years.
Yeah, I mean, it's mad because in those days in California, when I went in for bulimia, I went into a rehab unit. And I think all the signs were there then that I have some, type of addiction or some form of addiction. But in those days in America, the type of therapy was that it all goes back to abuse and you blame your parents.
Yeah, it's Freudian, basically.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And, you know, and I think that was the beginning of my journey too. You know, I was, like I said before, I was vindicated as a victim throughout my life through therapy. I was put on antidepressants after the incident in Mexico, a very high dose of Prozac. And I kind of thought, well, this is what I do. I suppress my feelings. Prozac wasn't enough, so I drank on it as well, you know, and that was my way to deal with life then. And it was almost became acceptable because my therapist and my doctors kind of endorsed it.
Yeah, kind of enabled, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I'm feeling for you because it's so sad because I know that place where you get into almost of acceptance that this is the lane I'm in, this is my life, this is what's happened, this is how it is. And you just trod along and trod along and trod along.
I think, you know, for me, I just kind of would think, is this it? You know, even because of this philosophical kind of interest I had, maybe that's what I was always seeking because I just thought, is this it? Is this life?
Yeah.
You know, one event, one trauma after another. You know, I didn't allow myself to get close to anyone because I was so scared of being hurt because the people who were supposed to love me, my parents, didn't show behavior or affection in a way that I thought was love. So I just thought, I'm going to shut myself off to any loving relationships, any very close friendships, you know, and I'm not going to ask anyone for help because whenever I would try and voice concerns to my parents, it was shut down, you know, and I think that's when I started to develop these coping skills for life. And it made me very lonely and very isolated and just trodding on this treadmill thinking, is this it?
Yeah, I totally get that. My mum was unbelievably loving. Dad was cold as ice. Although now in retrospect and seeing that he did love me and he'd do things... like if I needed a ride somewhere when I was older or drop me off somewhere or something had broke, he'd fix it. He was very like hands-on and practical in that sense. But when there were certain situations, my dad, for example, I remember I crashed a motorbike pretty bad and took all the skin off my side. And I remember he came down, a friend got him and I was in shock being sick. And he came down, he said, right, get yourself together, jump on that bike, get home and shower yourself off.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, right, fine. And there was quite a few instances like that that I'm grateful for now because I am so independent. I have to do things myself. I don't rely on anyone. I don't have anything to fall back on.
Yeah.
So I use it as a positive thing. Yeah. But for a long time, it was a burden because I knew I couldn't ask them for certain situations that I'd been in. I know I couldn't go home and say, oh, can we talk about this? It wouldn't happen.
Yeah.
And I took a lot of that on board. And that allowed me to have, like, I really wanted to have relationships with girls, and I could understand. My dad wasn't around for a long time because he was working. So in the beginning, I was around all females, like I am. My dog's a girl, my two girls, my wife and the mother-in-law, and the nanny's all female. And my upbringing was like that. So I loved being around women. I didn't like to be around guys because of all the violence and the heaviness and stuff. But I never knew how to be intimate in the sense of being honest and open. I always had to keep this guard up for a long time. And I'd kind of project it on the other person, like, you're not really open, you're not, but it was me.
Yeah.
And it was just guarding myself from any pain or hurt.
And isn't it mad that recovery teaches us these things? You know, therapy, for all the years I was in therapy, you know, I never thought it was, you know, all these coping skills that I developed in life. You know, I often say when my addictions really spiraled and when I finally surrendered, you know, almost a year and 3 months ago.
What was that moment?
Yeah, I mean, it was horrific, you know, 10 years trying to get clean. But then I think that's almost not true. I was never willing. I knew I had a problem, but the thought of life without the solution of an alcohol, something, you know, I was saying to a friend of mine the other day, you know, she said, you know, how did alcohol make you, why is alcohol different for you? Because, you know, we were talking about that 9 out of 10 people can drink normally, there's one who can't. And she said to me, what made you that one? And I said, imagine, you know, growing up, my life was black and white. It was this dismal black and white. And, you know, when I had a drink, it suddenly turned colourful. You know, my life became vibrant. And it allowed me to, like, basically exist. Otherwise, I was, you know, and for a normal person, their life's already colourful. They have a drink and it makes it slightly more vibrant. But for me, alcohol completely changed the way I felt. You know, when I would drink, it would just give me this relief. It was like, oh, now I can cope. Now I can cope with life. And so the thought of having to put that down, the thought...
It's quite terrifying, actually.
It was. And I am very stubborn and relentless person. And for, 10 years, I tried to put it down. But you know, they say when you come into recovery, you have to be honest, open-minded and willing. And I wasn't honest because I didn't want to put it down. I wasn't open-minded to another life because I didn't think there was another life. I thought this was it for me. You know, I didn't think it was possible to ever get out of this hole that I was in.
But you have.
I have.
You're amazingly eloquent about it.
Oh,
and I know you do a lot of work and you've helped Stride Foundation get into schools.
Yeah.
And I think we're going to be doing stuff together, hopefully, about that. It's really possible. You know, what's amazing is that there's so many people, and hopefully some of our listeners, that not hopefully they're stuck, but some people are stuck.
Yeah.
They don't realise that there is a way out, that you can walk away from your addiction.
Yeah.
Talked a lot about mindset, and I talk about that. A lot of people say explain their thought process. So on the outside, you could say, oh, yeah, I moved to California, got my own house, this is amazing, Ivy League school. But actually, inside, it's like a prison and it's horrendous and it's not anything to do with material stuff.
Yeah.
How's your mindset now, a year and a bit in?
You know, it's hard to explain. This kind of isn't it. I couldn't explain it better. You know, I'll come across people that I've had in my life for a long period of time, and they've seen me struggle over the last 10 years in and out of rehab, in and out of rehab. But there's been no change. You know, I have 6 months of sobriety, 9 months, but the restlessness and that irritability, it's still there. It's profound. It's worse than when I was drinking. I think sometimes I preferred when I was drinking than to when I wasn't. But this time round, a friend of mine said to me the other day, she was looking at me really strange. And I said, what's wrong? She said, I feel like you've been abducted by an alien. You're a completely different person, you know, and I can summarize it. You know, I remember when I went into rehab the last time, you know, I finally surrendered. I got to that point that I was going to die. You know, I had such severe psoriasis. There was pus coming out of my eyeballs. My organs were failing. And I knew, you know, for once, I always say it was my pride that almost killed me, not alcohol. Yeah. But I got to that point where I was just so lonely. They talk about it in recovery. And I knew that I didn't want to die. You know, I didn't. I had a beautiful daughter and an amazing son that our relationship had, you know, I'd separated myself from him because I didn't want him to see the pain anymore. You know, he tried, but I took a step back. I didn't want him. And my daughter, I just thought, how could I do this to my children when my parents did it to me? And so I asked for help for the first time in my life. And I went to an amazing rehab in Scotland. And I finally surrendered. I knew this was it. And it's changed everything. You know, it's changed fundamentally who I am. But then again, I never knew who I was. So perhaps I've just become who I was always meant to be.
Yeah, your friends will see that. I mean, they must be so proud of you.
Yeah.
Are your kids proud of you yet? Are they still not sure?
Let's just say, you know, my son, yeah, he's an amazing young man. He's done very well. And so far the disease, thank God, isn't on him. And that's one of my my things that I thought, you know, you go through a lot of thoughts when you hit that rock bottom. And I thought for me now, either I can break the cycle, you know, the cycle that my parents passed on to me, and that inevitably I would have passed on to my children. I have an opportunity to do that now. And I think that was part of my motivation, because I knew if I didn't, it would go another generation.
That's really brave of you.
Yeah.
Oh, well done. I want to speak to you for hours, but we've come to the end of our session and podcast. But I have so many questions, but I'll just ask.
Yeah.
For our listeners, if someone, either in addiction, they'll learn more.
Yeah.
If their drinking's out of hand or they have food issues, but they're not sure where to go and what to do, what would you advise them to do?
Well, firstly, I think it's really important that people understand that, you know, this is an illness. It's a chronic illness like heart disease or diabetes. You know, there should be no embarrassment or stigma. And, you know, there's so many, there's like the Stride Foundation, you know, there's fellowships, there's teachers you can reach out to. But it's so important that if you feel you're drinking because you don't fit in, or if you feel that drinking for you is a way to cope with life, or if you have alcoholism in your family, you know, there's all factors that could be indicators that, you know, and the problem is if you look at alcohol as a solution, you know, over a certain period of time, it will turn itself around, it will become a problem, and then there's no turning back. You know, there are places, there's charities like Stride. You know, even GPs now hopefully have more of awareness, but it's so important you go speak to somebody. And if, you know, that this illness is rife in your family and you don't feel you're being understood by your parents, you know, there's help for that as well.
Thank you, Yasmin. This podcast is brought to you by Stride Foundation. If you or someone you know is struggling with addiction, please head over to www.stridefoundation.com, where you can find links to resources that may help. You can also make a donation. Please make a donation. It will help us bring to you more episodes. And if you enjoyed This Is Powerful, please rate, review, and follow the podcast to share it with your friends, your family, anyone you can, and head over to social media. I always love to see and hear how you react to the episodes. and it's so helpful for our content to be shared. A huge thank you to my guest Yasmin today. What a show. I hope you enjoyed it. Thank you also to my beautiful wife, Dr. Federica and Marty, the best producer, Shannon Delwich, to Henry, you know who you are, and to Emma Long, who does all the hard work in the background. And there's a whole catalogue of episodes wherever you get your podcasts. But did you know you can also watch it on YouTube? Just search for This Is Powerful with Paul Scholfer.